Today is Friday, July 7th, 2006. My name is Sandy Fahler, and I am an interviewer with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today I am interviewing Barbara Wolf, professor in the Departments of Economics, Population Health Sciences, and the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She is also a faculty affiliate and past director of the Institute on Research on Poverty. She was recently appointed director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs. Good morning.
Good morning.
We're going to start with your early life. If you could talk about where and when you were born, talk about your childhood, your early schooling, talk about any family members, teachers, or others who encouraged you in your studies.
Well, I was born in Philadelphia in 1943. I'm an only child, born to parents who were refugees from Germany. I went to public school. I started in kindergarten. I lived just half a block from the school, so I tended to be a volunteer. I was always staying after to help the teacher, would decorate. My parents always thought that I was doing too much of that, but that was the teacher's job. They didn't need me to volunteer. But I grew up, these were all what are now called townhouses. I called them row houses, I think, at the time. There were lots of children there, and so it was kind of a neighborhood type of atmosphere. We moved when I was about ready to start junior high school, and we moved out to an area called Ballackin, which is a suburb area, and continued to go to public schools. Again, the junior high school was about a block and a half away, so it was easy to participate in a variety of activities at the school, and only when I went to high school did I have to go on a bus to get to school.
And what did your parents do?
My mother really stayed at home. When my parents first came to this country, my mother was the one who worked. She designed clothing. She also did alterations, and she had a degree in, I don't even know what she would call it, but it really was to design clothes. And in fact, she has a brother who for years was a designer of clothing. And my father joined other members of his family and started his own business. And so he had a business in which he sold to large, mainly men's clothing, was called Threads and Notions, so some of the things that you need to produce garments. Mm-hmm. He worked very hard. He was away a number of days because he would go on the road. But my mother was always around, and then my grandparents lived there, not with us, but in the same city, as did my mother's two siblings. So all of the family came to Philadelphia because that's where they had relatives when they came to this country.
And why did you move out to the suburbs?
Oh, I think my father's business became successful, and they thought that was what you did in the U.S. You moved to the suburbs, he had a plot of land. So we moved out. My mother did a lot more gardening.
Was public school a good experience for you?
Oh, it was good. I never thought of it, that children wouldn't have gone to public school.
Mm-hmm.
We just always went to public school. Well, we seemed fine.
And what were the expectations of your parents that you would go on to college?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Right. But it wasn't clear what type of college. In fact, when I was applying for schools, and I was looking to go away to college, my parents were a little puzzled by that. The tradition in my greater family that had been in the U.S. for several generations was to go to the University of Pennsylvania, which was the best of the options in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I decided I really would like to go further away, they tried to bribe me to stay by offering a car.
Oh my.
Mm-hmm. But I was intent on getting away. Because as an only child, I just thought I needed to do that. So
where did you go?
So I went to Cornell University.
And how did you pick Cornell?
Well, I did not have good advice. That was one of the, I was glad I went to Cornell, but it wasn't because I got good advice at my high school. They were singularly poor advice, I think, amongst the guidance counselor. I remember going in and talking to the guidance counselors and even getting advice to apply to all male schools. So it seemed, it was hard to get any really good advice. But most summers I went to camp up in the Poconos. And at that camp there were a lot of people that were going to various colleges and universities. And there was someone who was older than I was, had been to Cornell, and so it sounded like it was going to be good academically, it would be interesting socially, and it was in driving distance, so it wasn't that far away. So I could be come home as the spirit moved me. And then I also applied to a number of schools that were in the East. I applied to Barnard, I applied to Wellesley, so a lot of the kind of sister seven schools.
Mm-hmm.
I did apply to Penn and Penn State, mm-hmm. Penn State as a backup mm-hmm. school. So they were never all that far from Philadelphia. It was not that I looked at the whole country as an option.
So obviously you you had the grades to go pretty much anywhere you wanted to go.
I think so, pretty much. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
Did you know at the time you were applying, did you have any idea what you wanted to do?
I thought I wanted to major in psychology. It wasn't called advanced placement then, but we had some courses where people who were doing well had the option of taking it. I had taken a course in philosophy that I had really enjoyed, and somehow that led me to believe that what I wanted to major in was psychology.
Mm-hmm. And how was your undergraduate education funded?
Mainly through my parents. I did work summers,
mm-hmm.
but otherwise they funded this.
What did you do in the summers?
Oh, the first couple, while I was in high school, I would work at my father's business. I was treasurer of a lot of organizations as I was growing up. I always was quite good at that. I think from about third grade on, I was the treasurer of many organizations. And so I worked there as a bookkeeper for when I was in high school. And then after that, I did similar types of jobs, usually involving some sort of kind of bookkeeping, accounting. And in fact, in my first year at college, I also took accounting for two semesters because it was something that seemed to be quite so easy.
Was Cornell a good experience educationally and socially?
When I found what I wanted to do, it was. I started out, I spent, I guess, my first two semesters not at all sure what I wanted to study. I just spoke about accounting, and I found that was very easy and not a challenge, and so I didn't want to do that. I looked into psychology, which I thought I wanted to do, and you know there really were two schools, and this was really the experimental school that was mainly animal-based, and I was not interested in that. And so I happened to take a course in economics, which was much closer to my view of what I would have been studying in psychology.
And
I've been studying that ever since.
Did you have good professors?
I did. Very good.
Mm-hmm. And were they primarily male, or did you have a variety?
They were all male in economics. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I majored in economics, but I minored in political science, which was called government there. And that had a really interesting set of faculty members. And we also did some surveys at the time of the presidential election. Mm-hmm. So it was quite an interesting time. And of course, this was a very active political time as well.
Mm-hmm. When you graduated, did you know you were going to go on to school at that point?
No, I actually went to work at Yale in the Economic Growth Center, and I went from doing combination, I think, of administration to research, to when the person who was running the center left, I really took that position in terms of my activity. I wasn't called the executive director. But this was a woman who was very important to me. Her name is Marion Chamberlain. And she went on and started to work for a foundation in New York. And in sort of my year working under her, this was really the first woman who I had ever worked with, who is an example. That's really where I got the idea that I too could go to graduate school and become an academic.
So you see her as a mentor.
Oh, absolutely, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she's actually been, once I was at Wisconsin, she visited. I think she was at the Ford Foundation then and was involved in funding women's studies programs. And so because of the tie I had with Marion at the time, I was able to at least increase the probability of Wisconsin getting funds from her, because when she came, we would spend time.
How did you get that job?
The job at Yale?
Yeah.
Well, it was within economics. I had two of the professors I had at Cornell, Wright. I was moving to, I wanted to move to New Haven because of a relationship, and so they wrote to several people, and I got this job.
And you stayed there for a year?
I stayed there for about a year and a quarter. I actually graduated in 3.5 years. I graduated a semester early.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went, probably a month or two after I graduated, I started at Yale, and then I was there through the following academic year. And while I was there, I applied for graduate school.
Uh-huh. And where did you apply?
I only applied to the University of Pennsylvania. And the reason for that is that's where I was moving. And at that point, I would never, I guess I was much more of a follower then than I've ever been since. But I was moving there and I
school.
Right. So I only applied there and wrote, essentially, when asked why I was applying there, was that I was going to move to this area and it was the best option in that geographic area.
And at that point, then you knew your field would be economics.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So talk about your graduate experience then, graduate school experience.
I had an interesting experience. By that time I'd had my first child. So I had a child before I went to graduate school in that, essentially that year and a half interval. That's not true. I had my child in my first year of graduate school. So I started out and I only took two courses. The two kind of core, macro and micro, and then took the next semester off, but worked as a grader, so like a teaching assistant for that semester. And then when I went back, I got a fellowship. And then I went through, and it took me, I guess, well, in total, I had my degree. It was then 6 years, but that included that first year in which I only took the two courses. And in my last year, I was working at the Federal Reserve Bank 2 days a week. But after that, then I worked full-time at Bryn Mawr. And during that period of time, I had a second child as well.
And who were some of the people that you worked with? Who were the faculty that you worked with at Penn?
Well, the faculty that I work with at Penn include Richard Easterlin, who is now actually at University of Southern California. He is somewhat more of a kind of economic demographer than straight economics. I work with Paul Talbent, who unfortunately died way too young in age. And those were the primary people that I worked with.
And what was your specialization? What did you study? What did you do your research in?
Well, the fields I took were industrial organization, international. There really was no labor or public, which are what I ended up doing. And and then I did some economic demography, which is closer to what I did in my dissertation.
And what year then did you finish your PhD?
I finished in 73.
And then what happened?
Then I got a job, I didn't not look nationally. I only looked locally, and I got a job as an assistant professor at Bryn Mawr College. And I was there for 3 years. At the same time, I was working on a project. I should go back because this will be a little bit interesting.
Yes.
I was working on a project with people at the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia. So I was full-time at Bryn Mawr, and I also had this other position.
What was that project?
Well, what I wanted to do originally for my dissertation was, this was a time in which desegregating, I'm still not pronouncing it right, when the idea of desegregation of the schools was in the courts, it was one of the really important issues of the day. And the question I wanted to ask was whether the individuals who remained in the school, whether their achievement went down, or whether the reason that you got this overall argument that achievement would decline was simply that you just had a different mix. And so the average would look different, but it did not mean that the individual children would have been negatively influenced. So that was the topic I wanted to do. And in order to do that and get permission in the Philadelphia school districts, I spent a lot of time going from door to door through the administration building. And finally, what they decided was that I could do the project, but before I could submit it or it would become public, they would have to approve it.
They mean the
school board. Well, not essentially the school administration, because I was getting into a politically sensitive area, and they did not want to find themselves under the gun because of this graduate student's dissertation. So I decided, as did the advisors, I was working with someone named Julie Margolis at the time. We decided that was not possible. He would not spend 2 years of your life and then find that you couldn't use this research. So then I thought, switched to this economic demography, which also added a year to my being there because I had spent a lot of time in trying to do this topic. But then it turned out that at the Philadelphia Fed, Anita Summers, who was the spouse of one of the professors at the economics department at Penn, was very interested in this topic. And so I was hired there to do a project that looked at whether school resources matter and the composition of the school. So it was quite close to the original question I wanted to ask. So I got to do that research at the same time I was writing my dissertation, and it went on for a long period of time because it was a major project. We looked at the value added within schools. We did a huge amount of data collection. But because of the Federal Reserve Bank and their ability to negotiate, they were able to achieve an agreement that I could not achieve as a lowly graduate student.
I didn't realize a Federal Reserve Bank would be interested in those topics.
Well, it depends on which one, but this was a major question in terms of what was happening in the local region. And schools are fundamental to economic growth. Mm-hmm. And so they were interested.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm. So I spent, I would guess at least 4 years working part-time at the bank doing this major project.
So you were doing that. You were a brand new professor at Bryn Mawr. You had mm-hmm. two children.
Mm-hmm. I was busy.
Yeah, I guess. Well, then what happened? You said you stayed at Bryn Mawr for 3 years.
Right. While the Federal Reserve project was sort of coming to an end, and I've always liked doing research, I put in a proposal to NICHD to conduct research,
which is the
National Institute of Child Health and Development. And was not easy to do because it's not like working at the University of Wisconsin where there's all of this support. There's very little support there. But I put it together and I did actually win this grant, which bought off some of my teaching time because there it's three courses a semester. Although it's not necessarily three preparations. So I went in and they agreed to this, but only if they didn't need me to teach. And one week into the semester, this was the semester in which I had my funding, they called me in and said they needed me in the classroom. So that's when I said, this is not ever going to work for me. Okay. And so I went on the job market.
And
I came out to Wisconsin actually as the equivalent of a postdoc at the Institute for Research on Poverty. They had 2-year postdocs. They weren't called postdocs, they were called research associates. And these were all people who were interested in topics related to the vulnerable low-income population, which is what I was always interested in. And so by then I was separated. I came out with my 2 children and spent 2 years as in this wonderful position where I was doing research.
So you brought your whole program with you? Your project?
Yes, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And then there were lots of projects going on here, and it was a really exciting atmosphere. I used to say it's hard to believe they describe these 2 jobs as being similar, because this one had lots of active research colleagues, and there's a lot of support, and it was just an exciting atmosphere. So while I was here, I applied for a tenure track, I guess 2 different tenure track positions, and I got one. And so what was going to be a 2-year stay became a very long stay.
What was your first impression of Madison and the university?
Well, the university, you know, is much larger than any university I'd ever seen before. And less of an Ivy League, you know, from where I subscribe, I was at Cornell and Penn at Yale, so I was only at Ivy League institutions. And they are quite different than this. This, I think, is, in general, less subject to a set of norms. It's sort of more open to new ideas. It's easier to work across departments. It's much easier to do interdisciplinary work. And there's just more excitement about research. So that was sort of my reaction to the university. The physical layout was quite different. Then just sheerly, you know, the sheer size was quite amazing. And I'd never been to a place that had a school of agriculture, for example. I guess Cornell must have, but it was somehow so separate that Cornell is both a private and a public institution, and there isn't a whole lot of overlap. And so if you're in LNS, as I was, you'd know people who were in a few other colleges, but not the entire university. It's more separate than that. Madison was much smaller. When I said where I was going, people said, why would you ever go to Wisconsin? Isn't it too cold? In order to adjust and have my children adjust, I felt like I'd spent my entire first year salary on buying sporting equipment for us so that we would be able to go cross-country skiing, we could take advantage of all of the opportunities here.
How old were your children at the time?
My children, let's see, one went to kindergarten, 5 and 9.
And now you applied for a tenure track position. What department was that position?
That was in what was then called Department of Preventive Medicine, which is now the Department of Population.
And did you know a number of people? Did you know enough about that department from your work in the Institute of Poverty?
Well, while I was at Bryn Mawr in my 3 years, one of the graduates from there came back looking for someone who would work with her on a question related to health economics. And I was the person who really did more empirical micro questions. So I was the closest. And so I sort of got involved in the health area while I was at Bryn Mawr. I got involved to a limited extent. But I've had some interest. It looked like it was an interesting area.
Would you talk about your research, what it was then, what the focus was, and how it's changed, if it has changed over the years?
Well, when I first came here, I had been involved in a really large project that was looking, that was more in terms of development. So what I was involved in was a project that looked at a variety of outcomes for women and their children in Nicaragua. So this was a project that was funded both by NICHD, which I mentioned before, USAID, and the Ford Foundation. And I did this with a faculty member at Penn, someone who'd been a graduate student at Penn that was from Nicaragua, who had gotten his degree in demography. And so this was a big three-stage project in which we collected data first from women in Managua, and then we did their siblings, and then we were doing the rural area when the revolution took place and stopped our data collection. And so what I was really interested in was looking at what led to decent health outcomes, what led to looking at sort of nutrition, looking at sanitation, looking at the quality of housing, looking at sources of income, the type of labor force participation. So I was looking at the outcomes for children, but paying a lot of attention to what it meant, what led to higher incomes, more labor market success in a developing country. And I think that research probably went on for at least 10 years. There's enough data there to continue doing it. It was a very, very rich data set. And one of the things I did was at one point, I was hired probably a dozen undergrads at UW to clean the data.
Were you able to go back and get data, continue to get data?
Not after the revolution.
Not after.
No, and the trouble with it, and several times people seemed to be interested and willing to fund our going back, because it was one of the most comprehensive surveys that had ever been done. It was focusing not on the traditional instruments for economic growth, but we're really looking at individuals and how investment in education and in health and in information on nutrition would lead to better outcomes. But the trouble was, the addresses we had were always go down the block, turn left, and it's the house that's brown. Mm-hmm. You know, there were no numbers. And so how would we ever find these people? And I think there was an attempt at one point, the person who was in Nicaragua had gone back, and it just seemed impossible.
Now, did you do any traveling there?
I went to Nicaragua a number of times. Mm-hmm. I never was one of the data. I would help create the questionnaire and deal with issues. And then I was in charge of getting the data cleaned, and actually we ran the empirical analysis here. But I was never, you know, in the field, other than I would go down there. I met with all of the people who were doing the surveys.
Now,
at that point, I actually knew a little Spanish, which I've totally forgotten by now.
Were there Nicaraguans that were involved in this?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So the person who had been at Penn who went back, he was in Nicaragua, and he was in charge of the data collection. Without that, I think it would not have been possible. Mm-hmm. It was just an incredibly important to the success of this.
And what are some of the projects that you're working on now?
Well, subsequent to that, I really have focused on issues primarily in the U.S., although I've been involved in some comparative studies as well. So the areas in which I focus on now include broadly you would call human capital. So I look at things related to education. I look at things tied to health and coverage, healthcare coverage. I have always have a focus on the low-income population. And I've been involved in a number of projects that either look at the disabled or people as they retire. So that's sort of the nexus of things that I look at or have looked at over the years.
It all sounds so interesting and so important.
It is. It's really interesting. Yeah. One of the things that always strikes me when people have trouble finding a topic, So I looked, the world's full of interesting questions. Let me give you a set of about 25 and see whether any of those can interest you. Because I never understand why people don't have an unlimited set of interesting questions, right? So let's see, big topics that I've done. Probably I sort of evolved into doing a number of projects in the economics of disability because other people were involved. There were a set of people at the Poverty Institute that were looking at issues related to people with disabilities. And so I've done a large set of these research projects looking at the controversy over whether programs like Social Security are too generous so that they provide an incentive for people to drop out of the labor force. There had been a lot of studies that found that it was overly generous and that you got perfectly able-bodied individuals who would drop out of the labor force, suggesting that we ought to have a more restricted system. And in this research, which I did with a variety of different colleagues, what we really found is that the people who drop out are people who have various kinds of either So we were really arguing in a politically charged arena that, in fact, the policies were not too generous, that the cost to society of these programs was very, very little loss in terms of productivity, and that the consequence to these individuals and their families of cutting back would be very significant. It would lead to major hardship. Mm-hmm. And then I've been involved in other related projects that looked at what led to the economic well-being of individuals with disabilities. How can you promote reentry? The potential role of health insurance and ensuring that individuals have health insurance. I served on the committee that made recommendations on how to reduce the Supplementary Security Insurance Program, SSI, for children with disabilities. So I've always been involved in that. My most recent project was to look at when individuals receive Social Security benefits and drop out of the labor force. If you look at the full set of individuals, what do they look like in terms of their income and their wealth? How well off are they? What types of individuals are not doing well? Is there some way that maybe we want to restructure the program so that the minimum benefit is increased, so the people on the bottom who are really not doing well get more, where people at the upper tail who are doing fine could in fact do with less? So that's kind of been there. So that's one stream. Actually, a more recent stream has been to be concerned with the tie between income and health, and to try to disentangle an area that's very, very difficult to disentangle. The Russell Sage Foundation, maybe 8 years ago or so, started an initiative in which they wanted to look at the consequences of the increase in income inequality over the long run. And I was involved in two components of it. One was to look at whether or not you were likely to get more inequality in terms of schooling, because you'd have people who, as the income distribution was pulled apart, would people at the lower end getting less schooling, and so would you get a shift. And what we essentially find is that you're likely to get an increase in the level of schooling, but that at the bottom tail, you had more and more people who were going to get less education, so increasing inequality. And then another one that looked at health and coverage for health care to try to get some sense of what to expect in terms of the inequality in health due to this shift in income inequality. And that's led this in
controversial area. And so I've also had a lot of graduate students who work in this area. And I'm actually involved in trying to bring together, there's a whole group of scientists that are working on various kinds of biomarkers and to try to understand what stress does to the body. And then there's a set of us who are economists who have been trying to look at the link between income and health. But we have a black box. You know, we can say, well, it could be stress is trying to keep up. It could be because you're living in more in higher density housing, and so contagious diseases are more likely to go through those communities. It could be because you're struggling for food and the pattern of consumption. Could be many reasons, but we don't have the reasons. And then, at least to my perspective, people in the science community who are doing these biomarkers really don't understand the income and patterns and sources of income. So I'm really trying to work on getting us to talk to each other. And so in September at the Russell Sage Foundation, we're going to have a working group that's going to try to start to focus in on this. And there are other attempts, but none that I know of that have economists together with this group. So we'll see how it goes. I've been involved in a lot of issues around welfare reform, not surprisingly, given the poverty tie. And most recent work has really looked at whether a program like we have in Wisconsin, BadgerCare, which is given to parents, has positive benefits over and above just having a program for children, as they have in all but three other states. And so what we look at is the probability of having coverage, both for children and the parents. And then we're trying to look at the link to labor force, with the idea that if you are very low income as an adult and have children, you'd be eligible for Medicaid. So that inhibits you from really being successful in the labor market, because if you become too successful, you're going to lose that coverage. And in many of the firms you'd work for, there would be no coverage. And so we're trying to look amongst those people who are working, those parents who are working, whether there's any kind of tie between providing Badger Care and higher earnings.
How do you get the funding for these where does the funding come from for these projects? Is it primarily federally funded, foundation funded?
Primarily foundation funded at this point, things that are particularly tied to this low-income population. So the project I just described, this kind of Badger Care Fund, was primarily funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
Now, how much time do you spend trying to get funding or keep funding?
Not nearly as much as scientists.
Ah.
One of the advantages of actually getting funding through the foundations is it is actually an easier process than going through the federal government. I actually run a training program that's funded by the National Institute of Mental Health. So most of my graduate students, I have six pre-docs every year, are funded through that, and then that has a big application that I do every 5 years. And every once in a while I do one of those, but I find it's much easier to work with foundations. Mm-hmm. So, and once you start to work with them and have contacts, it's actually much easier and requires less time. I actually, with two other faculty members, put in a proposal to the National Institute of Aging on July 1st. So I've just gone through all of that. But I find it amazing how much time that takes. Whereas the foundations, it's a more of a interaction. I mean, there are, the actual budgeting process is actually more complicated. But for in terms of the content, they'll come back and ask questions, and it's more of a give and take.
I'd like to back up just a little bit. What was the tenure process like here?
Well, I have joint tenure in economics and
in what's now population health.
So does that mean you had to go through the process twice? Two separate tracks?
Well, it was one, but more than one. It wasn't two, though.
Uh-huh.
I've tried to suppress this.
Okay.
It was not a pleasant time. The whole process, there's a lot of it that's just set out by the university in terms of letters and the like. It was a long, drawn out, and very stressful process, I found. I was actually put up initially a year early so that there was an extra year, and I did not get tenure then, making it more stressful.
Sure.
But I did get tenure the second time around.
You said that when you came here, you realized that it was a much more open atmosphere than you found in Ivy League schools. And it sounds to me when you talk about your research that is true, that
right.
it's easy to work with faculty across the campus and make contacts.
There are experts here in everything. I mean, it's one of the exciting parts here. And it's fun to work with new people, most new people.
And is that mostly informal, how you get to meet these people and start working with them, or are there formal mechanisms to do that? I mean, how do you find people? Is it just because you've been here for so long?
Probably the easiest way for me to answer this is that I am frequently the individual that puts people together now. So someone new will come in, or they'll be talking about a project, and I'll say, oh, but so-and-so over in some other department's interested in that. You really ought to be in touch with each other. And then I might write a note to both of them, or saying, following up on a conversation, I'm putting you in touch. So I think a lot of it is just simply by word of mouth. That's how I would describe that, is by word of mouth. For me, a lot of this happened through the Poverty Institute, because that's a multidisciplinary type of group. When I was actually asked by the president of Russell Sage to put what was called one of these groups together to look at inequality, and so I brought together people in sociology, economics, population health, and social work, and we had a working group. That actually was probably an example of an attempt to get people beyond the normal kind of working together, because part of what was funded was what was called, because I put it together, it was called my dinner party, but there was funds in it so that once a month we actually went for dinner. And so we would go to have dinner, we'd try to get some area where we could talk, and around dinner we would all talk about our projects and interact, and it was terrific. It worked out really well, and it went on for years in that. We saved some money, so even when the project ended, we had a couple more of these. Because our research always goes on past the deadline of the funding.
Is the Poverty Institute unique to Wisconsin?
It was unique to Wisconsin. And now, however, I will be able to get these dates for you. It was unique for 20-some years. Then there was a competition, and there were two funded, one at Northwestern Chicago and the one here. And that was while I was director of IRP. So we did engage in this big national competition. And then that was for, I believe, 5 years. So when the next competition came, I was no longer director.
And where does that funding come from?
That comes from the Department of Health and Human Services. It's under ASPE, the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation. And now there are four poverty centers, three that are called regional centers and one poverty center. So there's one in Washington, there's IRP, there's one at the University of Kentucky, and one at Michigan.
Would you talk about your teaching experience? Do you enjoy teaching?
I really enjoy working with and teaching graduate students.
So I have this group that I support through this training grant in health and mental health economics. And we run a seminar every semester. And that's great fun. It's a really, and it's wonderful. They're bright. We look at the most recent literature. We study a variety of topics. I really, really enjoy it. That's probably my favorite part of all the things I do is working with students. When I teach undergraduates, I have a more mixed view because I've been so spoiled by these individuals who really are very involved and want to learn and very enthused. I do much better in smaller classes because I like to get to know people. So you put me in front of 60. I like the set that come in and that I get to know. But then I feel I have no contact with the others, and I find that very frustrating.
But you do teach?
I have, and now with both when I directed the Poverty Institute and now directing La Follette, I won't teach the undergraduates. I'll keep up teaching the graduate students. I've also done a course for population health, one of the required courses that has about 50 or 60 students in that. To me, that has the same flavor. I'd much rather be in a classroom where I get to know the students. So put me in a classroom with 20, fine. When it gets bigger and bigger, it's not something I enjoy.
Do you think you're a good teacher?
Only in the small, informal setting. And then I am, because I can draw people out, and we do fine. When I'm in front of, I spend an enormous amount of time in preparing lectures for undergrads. My tendency is to have at least twice the amount of material that would be optimal, because and you learn a lot, but you do it at breakneck speed.
Yeah. What about the writing responsibilities that you have in publishing? Is that something you enjoy?
Mm-hmm.
How much time do you think you spend on that?
Enormous.
Yeah.
I like writing the first draft. I like creating the stories. It's rare that you have something that you find that you can't sort of explain or isn't a puzzle. I like that process a great deal. I also like being involved in converting that to a publication like IRP has Focus or La Follette has a policy report so that it's accessible. And I like communicating so that people in fact will find research useful. But I'm not very good at the third, fourth, and fifth editing. I barely am looking at it anymore because my mind's on some new problem. So I'm not a very patient person at doing the rewrites.
How about public speaking? You like that part of your job?
Not so much. I get nervous. Don't really like to get up and make a public speech. I'm fine in the classroom. I'm fine at a professional meeting giving my findings. So my professional talk around my findings at a professional meeting, that's fine. The broader the audience, the more informal it's supposed to be, the more uncomfortable I am. Mm-hmm.
But you have to do it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I had one of those this afternoon.
Ah. Now, you've been a director, and now you're taking on another responsibility as director, which I'm assuming is administrative work. You like that?
I'd like creating opportunities for people. So one of the things that I like to do is get people involved in research projects. What I want to do with La Follette now is have more of an intellectual life, more of a bring in more visitors, have our own seminar series. So I like creating that. I also like working with junior faculty to try to increase the probability they'll get tenure. So those aspects I like. Then there's a whole set of it I don't like. I think I work relatively easily with people. I'm relatively even keeled. So I tend to get along with most people. Mm-hmm. So I delegate easily. I am not a controlling person.
And do you have to worry about budget? I mean, you had that accounting background, so that shouldn't be, except you have to fit.
Well, the trouble is finding the money. It's not keeping tabs of it.
Yeah. Would you talk about the La Follette School of Public Affairs? What is that? What is its history on campus?
La Follette started out, must be in the early 1980s, when I believe the legislature, but it could have been the governor, I don't know these details, decided that the University of Wisconsin system should have a School of Public Policy. There was no School of Public Policy. The policy actually is called the School of Public Affairs. It brings in public management and public policy. And there was then a committee set up, I was actually on that committee, to look at where it should be. But this was a committee that was largely put together at Madison, and Madison thought that this was the place it should be, which made a lot of sense given that we were going to focus on governance, and here was the state capital, and we could bring together people in particularly political science and economics. And so over time, it's grown. It started out not being a tenure-granting department. It just had people who had tenure elsewhere, or on tenure track elsewhere, and would spend some time, which was difficult because then people's loyalties were with the other department because La Follette had no say. Mm-hmm. And gradually over time, we, La Follette, successfully argued that point and became a tenure granting, and also over time changed the name from an institute to a school. There was some debate about whether it could be independent or remain within letters and science. And at the time, there's a lot of budget pressure, as there has been ever since, and the view was that La Follette would be too small to be independent, that it would really be a struggle. And through the cluster hires, La Follette actually has been able to grow quite successfully because La Follette is naturally goes across disciplines. Mm-hmm. And so for a number of clusters, from the poverty cluster to some of the international clusters, La Follette's been quite successful at being the home of a lot of the faculty. And so we're now, I believe, 19 faculty, although only 4 have their tenure home fully in La Follette. It's a very nice place. I mean, people are interested in public policy issues, and so it's very lively. It's a place where people have a lot of exchange. It's constrained because of the physical size of the building. It's too small and only 9 faculty have offices there. And so we actually have a plan and have a sketch to move to a building where everyone could be housed. And I think its next stage really needs that. But there are currently 2 degrees. There's a master's in public affairs, and then there's a master's in international public affairs now. So the international component is relatively new and has grown. There's about 130 students now, about 65 a year. Faculty would like to keep it at that size, not grow. A lot of people, you know, are quite prominent. The national meetings of the association are going to be in Madison this November.
Oh.
And the current president, one of the vice presidents, and I think 2 or 3 of the board of management are all from our faculty.
That's impressive.
It's very impressive, mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
How does one become the director?
Oh, it's the same as being the head of a department. Essentially, it's by, you have a committee that is looking, and you get, they do interviews of all the faculty, and then they try to convince you.
So is it a 3-year appointment?
Generally it's a 3-year appointment. I've actually only agreed for 2 years at this point. I feel like I've done my service at the Poverty Institute.
Well, that's an excellent introduction to the next question. If you would talk about your involvement on campus in faculty governance, committee work, other campus activities. What service activities do you enjoy the most and the least?
On campus, let's see, the activity I was been most involved in, but not recently, was I was a member of the athletic board.
Oh, you were?
Mm-hmm. So when Donna Shalala was here, one morning at 7:30, while my children were still in high school, she called and asked, she said, we need an economist.
And would I do that? I had never thought about it, but I had a son who was crazy about sports. So I figured if I'm going to do something, this was the right time. And at that point, she was suggesting to me it was only one meeting a month was not a major time commitment.
That
was
an
not exactly the yeah. story.
That was an exciting time for the athletic.
That was a very exciting time.
Yeah. Can you
so
talk
I was
about
very
it?
Involved in that for a number of years, and my final 2 years on it, I was the representative to the Big Ten.
Oh.
And so then I was involved in the committee that looked at eligibility. And so that was very time intensive because we used to get calls all the time because no school could ever wait. You needed to make a decision.
Sure.
So it was very interesting. I quite
I
found
bet.
That fascinating.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I was on that like, over a period of 9 years. I was on it for 7 years.
That's quite a commitment.
That was a big commitment.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But that was the time we made all these changes. So
I remember.
All right. So you were spending time, but you were getting action. So. It was an interesting time. It's actually, I found it a mixed time because you were getting called. I would get called at home from from the news media. I felt like I was being overwhelmed by it. And here, I mean, it is sports. It's important, but there were so many other things going on in the world that were getting no attention. And this kind of contrast, I found depressing.
Your work in the whole area of eligibility, though, I would think that you could contribute quite a bit to that. I mean, you think about, the students that come to campus in athletics where there are scholarships available.
Right. I'm a big proponent of that. Absolutely. And that's why I've always argued that it's really important because you get people trying to have sufficient grades so that they can attend it. Otherwise, we'd never do so.
Yeah.
So I agree with you.
Yeah.
Entirely. I think it serves a really positive purpose.
So it was a good appointment that they put you on
mm-hmm.
that group.
I think so. I hope so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now what about outside professional organizations that you're part of? What do you belong to? What's your extent of involvement?
Well, I have been on sort of the governing board of the American Economics Association. Before that, the Committee on the Status of Women in the Economics Profession, but then I moved on to the board and then the Nominating Committee of the American Economic Committee, American Economic Association. I've been very active in a group, the International Institute of Public Finance, which is an international group that meets and looks at social security and social insurance and a variety of issues like that, and served on the board and as vice president of that. The International Health Economics Association, which is a much newer organization. I was on the second round of the board of that, and I've been on the scientific committee ever since. We had the first meeting of the American Society of Health Economics here, and three of us in population health were the local organizing committee, and so we were very active in that, and I've been on the prizes, and probably pushed to have prizes. I've been on the board of the Association of Public Policy and Management and served on the dissertation prize and the nominations committee for that. I've done a lot of this.
Yeah.
I'm currently the associate chair of the Board on Children, Youth, and Families. That's a joint committee of the National Academy of Sciences and the Institute of Medicine that looks at issues that should be studied for this age group. I'm a member of the Institute of Medicine. And I'm currently been invited to be a member of the advisory committee to the director of NIH. It's this kind of 20-person committee that tries to set broad policy and also decides on some high-level awards.
Now that must involve, your involvement must mean that you do a lot of traveling.
I do a lot of traveling, way too much traveling.
Really? I mean, you don't like that part
of
it, or it's just too much?
Just too much. I'm now very good at getting work done on the plane. Very good. That's why I have this little computer.
Uh-huh.
Because it works fine and
sure.
plain.
Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. No, but it's a lot. Actually, my favorite of these committees is I'm on the National Advisory Committee of the Robert Wood Johnson Health Policy Scholars. And that's fun because you take really the most promising young scholars, and they get these wonderful kind of postdoc positions for 2 years. And then every year we go out and we hear about the research that they're doing and make comments on it. So that's been a kind of fun activity. I like that.
Mm-hmm. Does the state of Wisconsin take advantage of you with your expertise and other people on campus that have the kind of expertise you have? Do you work with people in state government?
Sometimes. I've been on a couple committees. I have served on committees that have looked at various types of rules and regulations. So when health maintenance organizations the concept first came up, and whether or not they should be allowed and facilitated in the state, I was a member of that committee. I have participated in a committee in Milwaukee that's looked at why our healthcare costs so high. I'm involved in planning committees there's something called a family impact workshop.
You were talking about your state government experience on committees. Did
right.
you find those experiences to be successful?
Well, certainly the earlier one on HMOs was very successful. That was an earlier time. I think the legislature was quite different. There was a lot more interaction. Tom Loftus was there. Lots of people that have gone on and been quite prominent. They wanted to hear. They wanted to interact. It was, the flow really worked. The Wisconsin idea was alive and well. I think it's much harder today. I think others who are students of who's running for government and the influence of various groups are better able to speak on this. But my observation is there's less interest. I think the reason I was asked to participate more recently in Milwaukee was it was still some of the same group that had been here at the state that represented this kind of more openness, wanting to hear from academics. I think that there's a lot of people at La Follette who have very good working relationships. This meeting that we're going to have an openness and interest in working with people at the university who work on those topics. To me, it seems less of it today than there used to be, which is unfortunate.
You see the director of the La Follette School on television a lot and quoted in the newspaper when there are issues that come up. It seems to me that it seems to come with one of the responsibilities as the director. Are you excited about that part of the job?
The honest answer is no. I have not. I don't particularly like that. If it's on a topic in which I feel knowledgeable, I'm comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the areas that have to do with healthcare policy or educational policy, I'm very comfortable. I feel like the more appropriate thing for me to do is to be someone that facilitates and says, you want to talk to my colleague so-and-so, and it shouldn't be me. And that's what's much more likely to happen.
I see. Would you talk about the climate for women on the Madison campus? How does it help or hinder the participation and advancement of women?
I think it's a mixture. Most of my time here, I have been the only tenured woman in the economics department.
Oh, really?
When I first came, Claudia Golden was here, but only for my first year.
Paula Voos was here for part of it. She was tenured after I was, and then subsequently left. I have found that difficult. I mean, I'm comfortable with most of my colleagues there, but not all. I found it hard to get recognized at meetings. My voice is not as loud as theirs. I am an assertive person. I have been much more than I ever was, because you have to be. But I think very carefully there about what I'm going to speak on. And it's frequently about an issue related to like a woman. Mm-hmm. So if there will be issues related to graduate students, I found myself a number of different occasions championing graduate students and pushing for graduate student issues in the department. And I think it is tied to being a woman. And I've disagreed with a lot of policies amongst my colleagues. So I have found that at times to be uncomfortable. It's not that every time I walk into a room I look around, but I then notice how different it is in my other departments where there's lots more women. And I feel more comfortable there, and I feel like there's a different opportunity to participate. So for me personally, there has been a difference. I was for 1 year the acting head of the Women's Faculty Mentoring Program that Robin Douthat started. I was active in that for a while. I've mentored a number of women faculty, most but not all of whom have been successful and received tenure, and I've enjoyed doing that. You know, I think there are extra challenges to being a woman on this campus.
Is it easy to form connections, networks available to meet other women on campus?
Well, the trouble is that in order to be successful, you have to do so many things that it's hard to do, I think. It's hard to take the time and feel like that's really worth doing.
So you do it where you can?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Right. For me, it's been more with women who are at the Poverty Institute. And my closest working colleagues have always been men. But that's the nature of being an economist.
And are there problems there? I mean, in your research and working with men on the projects, that's different from
that's
the, departmental issues.
Right. That's totally different.
Yeah.
Right. That's not an issue.
Right. Would you talk about any honors and awards that you've received that are particularly of importance to you, that meant a lot?
Well, I had for a long time as a goal being elected to the Institute of Medicine. I enjoyed participating in a number of their panels. I've been on the board of International Health for several years. I had been on a variety of committees there over the years. And that seemed like the place where I was most likely to get some type of honor. Mm-hmm. And so I was very pleased to be elected there.
And how did that happen? Did you know that you were nominated?
I did. At some point during the year, I knew I was nominated. And before I officially heard, when I went to this Robert Wood Johnson meeting, a person there said, "Did you know I nominated you?" And he said, "Given the way the election is going, I'm quite confident you're going to be elected." Which did happen.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And someone who's a member from here also had, you know, had sort of said, "It looks like you're going to be elected." So it was not a total surprise, but you never know.
Yeah. And when did that happen?
2001.
Any others that you want to mention?
Well, I was invited to give a plenary speech at the International Institute of Public Finance. And except for government officials who've been invited to talk, I believe I was the only woman. And on this board of the International Institute of Public Finance that I served on, either as a board member or as vice president, I was the only woman.
Those are the things that, you know, first come to mind. I was the first woman who was the head of the director of the Institute for Research on Poverty. I'm now the only woman who's ever been the director of La Follette. So,
that both of those are impressive. Well, now, if you would talk about your life after work, talk about your family.
Mm-hmm.
How do you balance your work and family? What do you do for fun and relaxation when you're not working? How do you keep yourself healthy and energetic?
Well, that's just easy. I play tennis. That's my favorite. Uh-huh. And I try to play 2 to 3 times a week or more. Mm-hmm.
Are you on a team?
No.
Oh.
I find that I can't do it because it's too constrained.
Yeah.
And with everything I do, it doesn't work for
mm-hmm.
me. So I generally play with friends. I'm doing a clinic at Shorewood right now.
Oh, so you're good.
Well, I've been playing for years.
Uh-huh.
Decently.
Uh-huh.
I've now taken up, just because my husband's playing, and so I finally gave in, I'm doing a little bit of golf. But I'm terrible. I go out for the sunshine and companionship,
right.
But I find it takes too long. I do lots of walking. I either walk with my dog or I walk with friends and our dogs.
What kind of dog do you have?
Cockapoo.
Oh.
He's very cute.
Yeah.
Very nice boy.
Mm-hmm.
So I exercise, do something every day. And that's important to me. I also have a gym at home, so during the winter I have no excuse. So I'm ready to, so I am physically active, big
mm-hmm.
into exercise.
Mm-hmm.
I have children and grandchildren, but not in Madison.
How old are your children and where are they? What are their names?
My daughter, whose name is Jennifer, is married, has 2 children. She's out in the San Francisco area. She's trained as a lawyer. She's small children right now, and she started her own business. And when she sells sun protective clothing that she and a partner have made in Australia, she's married to an Australian, and then import, doing well. My son, who's always been a big sports fan, is a play-by-play announcer. He is now at the University of Louisville. Where
it's
he does their football and basketball,
uh-huh.
mm-hmm, including their coaches' interviews. He also does some professional sports. He's, I guess on average, does 3 different things each week, I would say. So he does like a game of the week during football and basketball season in addition to Louisville. And then he does arena football, and he did the preseason Eagles games last year, and he does NFL Europe. He's busy.
So
he loves it.
Where does he live then?
He's now just moved and bought a condominium in Louisville. He was in Philadelphia. But
and
he
what's
just
his
moved.
Name?
Ari Wolf.
Mm-hmm. And your husband?
My husband's now a retired professor here.
Oh. And
so
what's his name?
Robert Hageman. Mm-hmm. So part of the reason that all of this works is that we do some joint projects together. And then we travel. We usually can travel together. Not in a lot of these little trips I make.
Mm-hmm.
But we've also been very fortunate. We both have appointments at Australia National University. So we're adjunct professors there, and we go and spend 5 to 6 weeks there a year usually. We've done that 6 times. Next year, we have an invitation to go to the Netherlands Institute for Advanced Study. So for any kind of extended period, it's worked really well. It's been terrific.
What is his field?
He does public economics, more benefit-cost analysis. He started out in resources. He also does poverty. He was one of the first directors of the Institute for Research on Poverty.
Mm-hmm.
So it works very well by having someone who's very interested in the same kind of field, and we do some projects together, some separate.
Mm-hmm. That's the end of the questions, but mm-hmm. if there's anything you'd like to add that we didn't cover that you'd like to get on the record?
Well, if I think about anything else I would add, I would probably put in a call for
more kind of appreciation, understanding of the multiple roles that people play. And to think, first, if you take a professional life, to not only focus on the roles very narrowly of teaching and research, that sort of mentoring, bringing along either graduate students or other faculty, I think is really important and is not rewarded sufficiently. You know, it's like a personal reward, but it's not something that I think the university sufficiently recognizes. And I think sort of trying to find some way to ease and allow people to be successful at this kind of relatively high pressure job. It's fun. It's fun. It's a great job. And we call it flexible, but it's only flexible because I can do my research at midnight. And I can take an hour off so that I can do something with a child or a grandchild. But it's not flexible in the sense that if you don't put in, you know, huge hours, you're not going to be successful.
That's an excellent point.
No, it really is a very demanding job. But at least it is flexible. It'd be impossible if it weren't flexible. You know, you couldn't do it. So,
yeah.
It's a great privilege kind of life. It's, you know, the privilege of working with people so that are bright and motivated is wonderful.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to do this.
Oh, my pleasure.
Very much appreciated.